There is a Cushlean legend of the Isle of Ys and its Dark Lady, who commanded the birds of the air and kept a tame osprey about her. Ys drowned, they say. I do not know the legend well enough to remember why, only that there was a lady, and her cormorants may still be seen fishing in the waters above the sunken isle and crying out for their lost mistress. Come, Melisande said, and held out one gloved hand for my lead. Truly, there was no command in her voice, only the simple expectation of obedience. I rose and followed her with alacrity. Chapter 35. I knew not what to expect from a Cushlean gathering, but in the end it was not so different from other fates, only a shade darker in tone, with an unfamiliar undercurrent and a preponderance of Cushlean accents, at once harsh and musical. It all fell to a hush when we entered. The Duke de Morban's herald gave our names, both of them, though I had not heard what Melisande had said to him. For those who heard, even anonymity was stripped from me, marking me not as some nameless servant of Nama, willing to contract on the longest night, but a member of a peer's household, collared and bound to Melisande Sharazai of my own free will. We moved among the guests, and a murmur followed. I could not but feel my nakedness beneath the sheer gauze with every step. Masked faces, feathered and furred, turned to watch our progress. Melisande glided smoothly between them, and I trailed tethered in her wake. And to my chagrin, with 100 eyes upon me, and Melisande's hand at the end of my velvet lead, I felt a desire such as I had never known stir in the distant reaches of my being, like the wave that had drowned Ys, gathering force in the far depths of the ocean.
"Your grace,"
only Melisande could make a curtsy seem the gesture of a queen receiving homage. A tall, lean man in a wolf mask inclined his head and looked gaugingly at her.
"House Sharazai arrives," he said dryly. "And what have you brought?"
She made no answer but to smile. I sank deeply in a curtsy. "Joy to your grace on the longest night," I murmured. His fingers lifted my chin, and he searched my eyes through the holes of my mask.
"No," he exclaimed, glancing at Melisande, then back at me. "Is it true?"
"Fedrano Delaunay," she said, with her faint smile. It curved like a scarlet bow beneath the black mask that hid her features. "Did you not know Elowa's city boasted a genuine Anguisset, your grace?"
"I cannot credit it."
Without removing his sharp gaze from mine, he reached forward and gathered up the sheer folds of my gown, slipping his hand beneath them. I cried out then, out of pleasure and shame both. The Duke de Morban regarded me from behind his mask, an amused wolf. Melisande twitched the line, and I staggered, dropping to my knees in defense. The tiny diamond sewn into my sheer gown bit into my flesh.
"The Duke de Morban is not your patron," she reminded me, one hand twining in my hair in a gesture that was half caress, half threat.
"No, my lady," I breathed. Her hand grew gentler, and I found myself leaning into it, pressing my cheek to the velvet of her skirts and inhaling her scent as if it were a sanctuary. Her fingers trailed down my throat, and I heard, as if from a great distance, my own answering whimper.
"You see, your grace," Melisande said lightly, "Cushiel's dart strikes true." "Well, have a care where it strikes," he snapped, turning away.
I could feel her low laugh thrumming through her, and a crimson haze rose to cloud my vision. I could not say what transpired during the remainder of the Duke de Morban's midwinter mask, and I tried, for Delaunay queried me at some length, having never known my wits to thus falter. I can only say that my time there passed as if in a fever dream. As blessed Elowa is my witness, I tried to pay heed to what passed about me and what conversations I overheard, but the slender velvet rope Melisande Sharazai had set about my neck had severed at last my connection with that far part of my mind that was ever thinking and analyzing at Anarfiel Delaunay's behest, and I was aware only of her hand on the far end of it.
When I reached for that calculating corner, I found only the indrawn susurrus of the great wave gathering, and knew myself doomed when it broke. If you were to ask me what I remembered of that mask, it is only this: Melisande. Every laugh, every smile, every movement, all thrummed along the velvet cord that bound us, till I was nearly gasping with it. There was a pageant. I remember nothing of it, except the outcry of the horologer, Melisande clapping and her smile. I see that smile still in my dreams. And too many of them are pleasant. It is a small mercy that Jocelyn was not there to see me. When at last we left, the guests were fewer. Now it seemed I stumbled in her wake, and when the coachman handed me into the trap, I was quivering all over like a plucked harp-string. The velvet lead line grew tight between us. She had not released it, getting into the coach. "Come here," Melisande whispered as the coach lurched into motion, and there was still no order in it. But the velvet cord twitched, and I slid, helpless and obedient, into her arms. Eleanor knows I had been kissed before, but never like this. Everything in me surrendered to it, until she released me and pulled off my mask, stripping off the last vestige of disguise. Hers she kept, glowing blue eyes flanked by the dark upsweep of cormorant wings. And then she kissed me again, until I could return it with no artistry, but mere craving, clinging to her and drowning under her mouth. Until the coach stopped, shocking me with its suddenness, Melisande laughed as the coachman opened the door onto her own courtyard. I could not imagine that we had arrived so soon. He helped me out, face studiously averted. I cannot even think what I looked like, glaze-eyed, tousled, and naked beneath the expanse of diamond-studded gauze, and the velvet line grew taut. Too far from her, I shivered with dismay until she disembarked and guided me gently into her home. It was the longest night. It had only begun. What befell afterward I relate without pride. I am Kushiel's chosen, as she was his scion. This had been a long time coming between us. With Baudouin, I had seen her pleasure chamber. This time I saw the inner sanctum that was her boudoir. Little enough I saw of it, at that first glance. Lamps burning scented oil, a great bed, and from the highest rafter a single hook hung. That much I saw. And then she bound my eyes with a velvet sash, and I saw no more. When she took the slip collar and lead from about my neck, I almost wept. But then I felt them again, the familiar cord binding my wrists as she raised them above my head and looped them securely about the dangling hook. "For you, my dear," I heard her whisper, "I will not dally with lesser toys." A sound then of a catch being lifted. I hung suspended, too high to kneel, too weak to stand, and wondered what. "Do you know these?" The cold caress of steel against my cheek, a razor-fine edge tracing the line of the sash binding my eyes. They are called flechettes. Then I did weep, and it availed nothing. The fine blade of the flechette, keen as a chirurgeon's tool, trailed down the length of my throat and brushed the neckline of my gown. How much that diamond-spangled gauze had cost, I could not guess, but the sheer fabric parted with a sigh, and I could feel the brazier-heated warmth of Melisande's bedroom against bare skin. The sleeves were pulled around my upwardly wrenched shoulders. The flechette traced the veins in my bound wrists, not breaking the skin, down the length of my arms to whisper effortlessly through the gauze. I felt the gown slither away, tangling about my ankles, the tiny diamonds clicking against each other. "Much better." The fabric was withdrawn and tossed to one side. I heard it rustle and click in falling, and turned my head after the sound. "You don't like having your eyes bound, do you?" There was deep amusement in Melisande's voice. "No." My skin shivered all over involuntarily, and I fought to remain still, fearful of the deadly point of the flechette. It was hard to do, suspended like that. The blade moved softly over my skin, and the point of it pricked between my shoulder blades.
Ah, but if you could see, the anticipation would be so much less, she said softly, drawing the flechette down the length of my spine.
I didn't answer. I was shuddering like a fly-stung horse, and I couldn't stop the tears that steadily soaked the velvet binding my eyes. Fear made my mind a blank, and a yearning so sharp it was like pain made breathing a struggle.
Such desire, Melisande murmured, and the tip of the flechette danced over my skin, pricking my taut nipples.
I gasped, bound hands clenching involuntarily, making the chain sway. Melisande laughed. And then she began to cut me.
Any warrior wounded in battle has taken far worse from a blade than I had from Melisande's flechettes. I dare say it was nothing to the knife slash Alcuin had endured. But the point of the flechette is not injury. It is pain. The blades are unimaginably sharp, and part flesh nigh as easily as gauze. One barely feels it when first it pierces the skin. This is why the subsequent cutting is done very, very slowly.
Blind and dangling, gripped by terror and longing, my entire consciousness narrowed to the scope of the flechette's blade as it harrowed my flesh with agonizing slowness, etching an unseen sigil on the inner swell of my right breast. I could feel the blood running in a steady trickle between my breasts and down my belly. My skin parted before the blade, and flesh was carved by it. It was like the pain of the Marquist's needles multiplied a thousandfold. How long it continued I could not say. Forever, it seemed, until she stopped cutting and traced the point of the blade slowly down the path my blood had taken.
Phaedra, Melisande's voice whispered softly at my ear. I could feel the warmth of her body. The tip of the flechette trailed downward from my belly, a cool and deadly caress, until I felt it hovering near my nether lips and trembled like a leaf. I knew where next the blade would go. I could almost hear Melisande's smile. Say it.
Hyacinth! In a paroxysm of terror, I gasped the signal, and every muscle in my body went rigid against the force of the climax that overtook me. Not until it ended did Melisande laugh and withdraw the flechette, and I sagged limp at the end of the chain.
"You did very well," she said tenderly, removing my blind. I blinked upward in the lamplight, half-dazzled, as her beautiful face swam into focus. She had taken off her mask, and her hair fell loose, rippling in blue-black waves.
"Please,"
I heard the word before I realized I'd said it.
"What do you want?"
Melisande cocked her head slightly, smiling, pouring warm water from a ewer over my skin. I didn't even glance as it sluiced away the blood.
"You,"
I whispered. I had never asked it of a patron before. Never. In a moment Melisande laughed again and unbound my hands. Afterwards she was well pleased and let me stay, toying with my hair. "Delaunay sought your training well," she said in her rich voice, sending a thrill through every fibre of my being. "You could match your skills against any house in the Night Court, my dear." She drew one finger up the line of my mark and raised her brows. "What will you do when it's done?" Even now I shivered at her touch with the aftershocks of pleasure.
"I don't know. I've not decided."
"You should think on it. You're near enough to it," she smiled. "Or has Delaunay some target left for you?"
"No," I said. "I don't know, my lady."
She wound a lock of my hair around her fingers. "No? Perhaps he's satisfied, then. He used you to gain access to Barquier L'Envers, didn't he? And used the Duke to gain revenge on the Stregazza?" She laughed at my expression. "Who do you think taught Anafiel Delaunay to manipulate others, my dear? Half of what he knows I taught him. He taught me in turn to listen and observe.
and the two skills together are more formidable than either alone could hope to be.
He said you were well matched in many ways, I said.
All but one. Melisande tugged gently at my hair and smiled. Sometimes I think we should have wed anyway, for he's the only man who truly makes me laugh. But then his heart was given long ago, and I think a large part of it died with Prince Roland.
Roland? I sat upright, staring at her, my wits scrambled into a dazed sort of alert. Prince Roland?
You really didn't know, did you? Melisande looked amused. I wasn't sure.
Yes, of course, ever since they were together at the University of Tiberium. Even Roland's marriage couldn't come between them, though of a surety, Delaunay and Isabel detested each other.
You've never read his poetry?
There's no copy to be found in the city.
My mind reeled. Oh, Delaunay keeps a book of his verse locked in a coffer in his library, she said idly.
But what's he up to, then, if he's no longer using you as his eyes and ears?
Nothing, I said absently, trying to remember. There was a coffer. I'd seen it atop a high shelf on the eastern side of the room. It was dusty and uninviting, and I'd never wondered what was in it.
Reading, waiting for word from Quintilius Rouse. Nothing?
Too late I remembered where I'd heard him mention Quintilius Rouse, and glanced quickly at Melisande, but she was disinterested.
Well, mayhap he'll have sent a message with the Duke de Morban's party. Rouse's fleet is anchored just north of Morban.
She drew me back down, tracing the lines of a sigil carved into my skin. The bleeding had long since stopped, but the lines were clear.
He'll want to see you.
De Morban?
Delaunay, Prince Roland, oaths and poems and coffers. Melisande's mouth moved on me, following the lines she had graven, and it all went out of my head.
He's a Cushaline lord, albeit a half-bred line.
Melisande drew back and watched the flush mount to my cheeks, amused.
Choose as you will, but remind him who he has to thank for the knowledge of you.
With no bonds, no blades, no pain to compel me, she parted me effortlessly and slid her fingers inside me.
Say your little friend's name again, Fedra. Say it for me.
There was no reason for it, no reason to give the signal.
Hyacinth,
I whispered helplessly, and the long cresting wave broke over me once more. In the morning I woke in a guest room, and one of Melisande's efficient servants drew me a bath and brought my own clothes to me, neatly laid out upon the bed. When I was conducted to the dining hall, Jocelyn was there, and I was hard put to meet his eye. For his part, he was inclined to ask no questions, seeing me apparently hale. Indeed, I had been in far worse condition, physically, at least, after my assignation with Childeric Desarmes, and I think Jocelyn was somewhat relieved. As she had before, after the night with Baudouin, Melisande came to bid me farewell. She greeted Jocelyn graciously, and he bowed stiffly in response.
"Perhaps 'twould be best if you kept this, Carceline," she said, tossing him a purse. "On Nama's honour."
To me she turned smiling and slid something over my head. It was the velvet cord. She tied it off and settled the teardrop diamond in the hollow of my throat. I felt the relentless tide of desire surge in me.
"That," Melisande said softly, "is for remembrance, and not for Nama."
Then she laughed and gestured to a servant behind her. He came forward with a bow and filled my arms with a tattered mass of diamond-studded gauze.
"I've no need of rags," Melisande added, wickedly amused, "but I've a certain curiosity to see what an Anguissette, trained by Anafiel Delaunay, will do of her own accord."
"My lady,"
it was all I could get out, meeting her gaze. She laughed once more, kissed me lightly, and left. Across the table Jocelyn stared at me. With my arms full of gauze and diamonds, I stared back.
Chapter 36.
Delaunay's home was quiet. It was early enough yet that nigh everyone, the housekeeper told me, was asleep yet, including his lordship. The longest night, by tradition, was a late one. Jocelyn handed me Melisande's purse and excused himself, with red-rimmed eyes, to get some sleep. He had slept not at all, maintaining Eloise's vigil. I'd had little enough of it myself, but my mood was strange, and sleep seemed far away. I went to my room and put Melisande's patron gift in my coffer, mulling over the amount it contained. Then I closed the lid and sat on my bed, holding the remnants of my costume. It was enough. It would be more than enough. I had no idea what to do. Too much had happened in one night for my mind to compass. My gaze fell once more on my coffer. That at least I could learn for myself, I thought, and went down to the library. I'd remembered rightly. Though I had to crane my neck to see it, there was indeed a coffer gathering dust atop a high shelf along the eastern wall. I listened for sounds of stirring, and heard none. Dragging the tallest chair I could find over to the shelves, I stood atop it and reached for the coffer. I lacked a good foot of attaining it. With a whispered apology to Shemhazai and the scholars of the world, I piled several thick volumes on the seat of the chair and clambered up to balance precariously on them. My fingertips grazed the gold fretwork adorning the coffer, and I succeeded in dragging it within reach. Holding the coffer carefully, I dismounted from my perch and set to studying it. The rich wood was dimmed beneath a thick layer of dust, and the edges of the fretwork fuzzy with it. I blew gently upon it, raising a cloud, then examined the lock. There are merits to befriending a Tsingano. Hyacinth had long since taught me to pick simple locks. I fetched two hairpins from my room, bending the end of one into a tiny hook with my teeth. Manipulating them delicately, listening all the while for the sounds of the household rising, I soon caught the tumbler inside the lock and sprang open the latch. An odour of sandalwood breathed into the still air of the library when I raised the lid of the coffer. Melisande had spoken truly. It held a slim volume, silk-bound and untitled. Opening the book, I saw page after page of verse in Delaunay's hand, younger and more painstaking than his current fluid scrawl, but clearly the same. Smoothing the pages open, I read the verses written in faded ink. O dear my lord, lest this breast on which you have leant, as close in love as a foe in battle, unarmed, unarmoured, grappling chest to chest, alone in the glade where birds startled at our voices, laughter winging airborne, we struggled for advantage, neither giving quarter. How I remember your arms beneath my grip, sliding like marble slickened, your chest pressed to mine, heaving, as our feet trampled the tender grass, your eyes narrowed with tender cunning, and I, unaware, until your heel caught my knee. I buckled, falling, vanquished. O sovereign adored, to be pierced ecstatic by the shaft of victory, sweet the pain of losing, sweeter this second struggle. O dear my lord, let this breast on which you have leant serve now as your shield. Melisande had not lied about the book. If Delaunay had written these lines, surely he had written them for Roland de la Courcelle, who had died at the Battle of Three Princes. Roland, whose word Delaunay had upheld when he went back for Alcuin. Roland, whose wife Delaunay had branded a murderess, whose father the king had ordered Delaunay's poetry anathematized. No wonder he hadn't dared banish him. A small sound caught my ear, and I spun about to see Alcuin standing stock still and open-mouthed. Too late, I closed the book. "You shouldn't have done that," he said quietly. "I had to know." I closed the coffer and latched the lock. "It's what Delaunay taught us to do, after all," I added, returning his gaze defiantly. "Help me put it back." He hesitated, but the long bond of tutelage between us won out. Alcuin came over to give me a hand up, steadying me while I returned the coffer to its dusty resting place.
we replaced the other books and the tall chair, erasing the evidence of my trespass, then listened. All was quiet.
So, I folded my arms, Delaunay was Prince Roland's beloved. What of it? Roland de la Courcelle has been dead 15 years and more. Why does House Courcelle still traffic with Delaunay and award him couriers and Castelline brothers and the like? And why does he make peace with the Duc Lanvert, who is brother to his equally dead enemy, the Princess Consort?
Alcuin's gaze looked past me. I don't know.
I don't believe you.
He looked straight at me then.
Believe as you choose, Phaedra. I made Delaunay a promise too.
Who told you? Melisande?
I didn't answer, and he frowned.
She had no business. Would that I could tell the difference between amusement and ambition in that woman. I'd sleep easier for it.
What I now know, I said, half the peers of the realm knew already, and I think no one is anxious to kill for it. Isabelle de la Courcelle had her revenge when she had his verses banned. Telesis de Mornay told me Delaunay might have been the king's poet if matters hadn't fallen out differently. It's what he became, instead, that is dangerous to know.
And do you suppose Melisande Charizai isn't clever enough to send you fishing for it?
Alcuin raised his brows. I felt a chill at the thought and kept my silence. Alcuin had said he would tell me what he knew when I made my mark. He had promised not to speak of it before then. The long-ago prophecy of Hyacinth's mother echoed in my memory, and I was suddenly afraid to tell him what Melisande had given me.
"Will you tell Delaunay?" I asked instead.
He shook his head somberly.
"It's your decision. I'll have no part of it, Phaedra. If you're wise, you'll tell him, but I'll leave it to you."
With that he left me, feeling more alone than ever I had in Delaunay's service. In the end, I temporized. I told him everything, all that I could remember, except the part about Prince Roland and the book. He made me go over the Duc de Morbihan's mask 12 times over, at last giving up and turning his attention to the diamond-spangled cloth, turning it over in his hands and shaking his head.
"What will you do?" he asked at last.
I'd had a little time to give it thought, and clasped my hands together, gathering courage to voice it.
"My lord," I said, keeping my voice steady, "in the Night Court, when an adept has made their mark, they may stay in the service of their house and rise within its ranks until such time as they choose to retire. I don't wish to leave your household."
Delaunay's smile was like the sun rising after the longest night. "You wish to stay?"
"My lord," I swallowed against the lump of mingled fear and hope in my throat, "do you permit it?"
He laughed out loud, drew me into his arms, and kissed me on both cheeks.
"Do you jest? Phaedra, you take enough risks to turn my hair grey with fright. But I'm the one who taught you to do it. Since you will take them whether I will it or no, I would sooner you do it under my roof, where I can safeguard you somewhat, than anywhere else in the realm."
Delaunay stroked my hair.
"I'd half thought I might lose you to your Tsingano boy," he said, not entirely in jest, "if not House Charizai."
"If the Prince of Travellers thinks I'd been waiting for the moment my mark was made, that he might deem me worthy, he's sore mistaken," I said, giddy with relief. "Let him court me if he wishes it, and Melisande is too interested in seeing how far I will run with her collar on me," I added, fingering the diamond at the end of the velvet cord, colour rising to my face. Delaunay forbore to comment on it, for which I was grateful.
"Phaedra," he said instead, his tone sombre, "you are a member of my household, and bear my surname. If ever you doubted it, know well I would never, ever cast you out."
"Thank you, my lord," I murmured, unexpectedly moved. He grinned at me.
"Even if your service fills Nama's coffers and your own rather than mine,"
he hefted the remains of my gown,
"shall I send this to a gem merchant, then?"
"Yes, my lord," I said, adding fervently, "please."
It would be some days before the whole of the transaction could be completed, With Delaunay's permission, I took a sullen Jocelyn as my escort and rode to Knight's doorstep, albeit by day. Alcuin lent me his saddle horse, and though the winter air was bitter, it was a pleasure to ride on horseback rather than cloistered in a coach. My last memory of a coach had too much of Melisande Shara's eye in it, and I welcomed the cold air clearing my thoughts. I wore the diamond, though. I couldn't quite bear to remove it, and tried not to think too much about why. Hyacinth was supervising a handful of young men, easing a battered carriage into the stables he leased. "Phaedra!" he shouted, catching me in his arms and swinging me around. "Look at this! I've nigh got a full-fledged livery service now. A noble's carriage, and I bought it for a song." Jocelyn leaned against the weathered wall of the stable, ashen garments rendering him nearly invisible. "Then you paid a verse too high, Tsingano," he said, nodding at the warped wheels and missing spokes. "Stripping that fancy trim won't cover the cost of repairing the wheels." "Happily, Sir Carceline, I know a cartwright who will also work for a song," Hyacinth said mildly. He turned back to me and grinned. "Delaunay let you out of your cage? Can I buy you a jug?" "I'll buy you one." I jingled the purse at my belt. "Come on, Jocelyn, it won't kill you to set foot in an inn. Cassiel will forgive you if you stick to water." Thus we ended at our familiar table in the back of the Cockerel, though with the unfamiliar addition of a Castlean brother, seated in the corner with folded arms, steel glinting off his vambraces as he scowled at the other customers. The innkeeper looked almost as displeased at Jocelyn's presence as he did himself. I told Hyacinth most of what had happened. He fingered the diamond at my throat and whistled. "Do you know what that's worth?" he asked. I shook my head. "No, a fair amount." "A lot, Phaedra. You could do quite a few things with the money it would bring." "I can't sell it." Remembering the cord taut around my throat, I flushed. "Don't ask why." "All right." Hyacinth regarded me curiously, his black eyes lively with intelligence. "What else?" "Jocelyn," I fished a coin from my purse and slid it across the table, "will you buy a jug and bring it to Hyacinth's crew in the stable, with my regards?" The Castlean looked at me with flat incredulity. "No." "I swear it's nothing like the other time, and naught against your vows. It's just somewhat... well, you'd rather not hear. I'll not stir from this chair." I grew annoyed as he sat unmoving. "Name of Eloa, do your vows say you have to remain glued at my side?" With a sound of disgust, Jocelyn shoved his chair back and snatched the coin from the table, heading to the bar. "Let's hope we won't find him in need of rescue," Hyacinth said, watching him go. "What is it?" I told him quickly about Delaunay and Prince Roland, what Melisande had said, and the book of verse. Hyacinth heard it out. "No wonder," he said when I was done. "So he was neither brother nor betrothed to Edme de Rocaille after all?" "No," I shook my head. "No, he wasn't avenging her. He was protecting Roland, I think. You never looked?" "I said I would not use the Dromond in this. You know why." It was the wholly serious tone I doubted many had heard in Hyacinth's voice. "Your mother's prophecy," I glanced at him, and he nodded briefly. "Either it came to naught, or it waits the day I know the whole of it." "Pray it is the former," he murmured, then recovered his spirits, flaunting his white grin. "So, you'll no longer be of Rajna's servant, Phaedra no Delaunay. You know what that betokens?" "It means I can aspire to heights on my own, greater than I've reached as Delaunay's Anguisset," I said coolly. "Mayhap one day I'll have my own salon, which might even surpass the fame of Cecily Laveau-Perrin, who trained me. Who knows what suitors that will bring?" It took the wind from his sails, momentarily gratifying, but it wasn't easy to discomfort Hyacinth. He touched Melisande's diamond where it lay in the hollow of my throat. "You know what it will bring, Phaedra," he said. "The question is, what will you choose?" Annoyed, I slapped his hand away. "I'll choose nothing now. I've spent all my life at someone's bidding.
I've a mind to taste freedom before I choose to give it up again.
I'd put no collar on you, he grinned at me again. You'd walk the long road with me, free as a bird, the princess of travellers.
The Tsingani collared your mother with shame, I said, glowering at him, and set her to washing clothing and telling fortunes for copper pennies. And if the stories are true, they'd collar your Dromond, prince of travellers, and set you to playing the fiddle and shoeing horses. So don't ply your O Star of the Evening whiles on me.
Oh, you know what I mean,
he shrugged, undisturbed by my ire, and plucked the velvet cord at my throat.
I'd not parade you half-naked before the peers of an entire province, Fedra.
I know, I whispered. Hyacinth, that's the problem. I don't think before that moment that he truly grasped the nature of what I was. He knew, of course, had always known, and had been the one person who'd never cared for what, but only who, I was. I saw him comprehend it now, and feared. It could change everything between us. Then he flashed his irrepressible grin.
So? He asked, and shrugged, miming the crack of a whip. I can learn to be cruel, if that's what you want. I'm the Prince of Travellers, he boasted. I can do anything.
At that I laughed, and took his face in my hands and kissed him, and caught my breath when he returned it, kissing me back with unexpected skill and sweetness. They'd taught him well, the married noble women with whom he dallied, until Jocelyn's mail-backed fist slammed my change onto the table, and both of us jumped, guilty as children, to meet the Castellan's dour gaze. Riding homeward beside him in the gloaming winter twilight, I glanced at Jocelyn's forbidding profile and ventured to speak of it. "I told you there was no harm in it, and no concern of yours," I said, irritated by his silence. "My mark is made. I've no bond to betray now."
"Your mark is not yet limbed, servant of Nama," he said stiffly, and I bit my tongue. It was true. He looked straight ahead. "Anyway, it's not to me where you bestow your gifts."
Only a haughty Castellan could have summoned that much contempt for the word. He set spurs to Delaunay's saddle horse and left me scrambling to keep up, detesting him once more.
Chapter 37. In due time, the deal with the gem merchant was concluded, each tiny diamond assessed for its quality and worth, and when all was tallied and counted, I was presented with a goodly sum of money. With Jocelyn's rebuke still stinging, I wasted no time in arranging a final appointment with Master Tialar. I confess I looked forward to the day with no small excitement. Like most servants of Nama, I had made my mark in slow, agonizing inches. To have it done in one blow, as it were, was a coup indeed. Alcuin had done it, of course, but Alcuin had forced his patron's hand to it and done penance to Nama for it. Melisande's gift, whatever motivated it, was genuine. Whatever strings were attached to her gifts lay in the one about my throat, and not the one to be limbed on my back. Until the day of my appointment arrived, I dwelled in a strange hinterland, neither bond servant nor free Dangeline citizen. For once, though, I did not chafe at my confinement, but strove to make sense of all that had happened, not the least of which was my last encounter with Hyacinth. I had a strange longing then to see his mother. I wish now that I had seen her. Delaunay would decry it as superstition, but there was a grim truth in her prophecies. Perhaps things might have fallen out differently if I had. The wisdom of hindsight is always flawless. I know now that I should have told Delaunay the whole of what had befallen between Melisande and I. I should have told him that I knew about Prince Roland. Indeed, I should have guessed it for myself. Of all the shadows that darkened Delaunay's soul, that had always been foremost among them, the battle of three princes. Roland had fallen. Delaunay had failed to save his liege lord. I had thought that was all it was. But now I looked at him differently, remembering the words of his poem. O dear my lord, let this breast on which you have leant serve now as your shield.
He had loved Roland and failed him. Roland was always rash, de Launay had said, his voice bitter. It was his only flaw as a leader. I should have known. So I think and doubt and second-guess myself. But in truth, would it have mattered? I cannot know. I never will. The day of my final appointment with Master Thielard dawned cold, crisp, and bright. De Launay, half his mind elsewhere, was expecting a visitor. He agreed, unthinking, to the loan of his horse and Alcuin's, so my surly Castellan companion and I rode to the Marquis's shop. Master Thielard was not a greedy man. He was an artist, and no question about it. But artists no less than other mortals, and betimes more, aspire to heights unreached by their peers, and I saw his aged eyes glimmer at the sight of the gold I offered, and the prospect of an Anguissette's mark fulfilled. I was the first in his lifetime. We spent a fair amount of time in the stifling hot back room of his shop, confirming the design and the lineaments of my mark. I could see Jocelyn through the curtain, waiting with outstretched legs and folded arms. Well then, let him wait. I was not about to rush the completion of my mark upon a youthful Castellan's impatience. I had only just disrobed and felt the first blow of Master Thielard's tapper pierce my skin when the commotion arose in the front room. As it was no business of mine, so I thought, I remained upon the table, while Robert Thielard sent his apprentice to investigate. I wish now that I had known Master Thielard's apprentice's name. I never did, and I am sorry for it now. He came through the curtain, eyes wide.
"There is a man, master," he said. "He insists upon seeing Milady, upon seeing Ferdinand de Launay. The Castellan has him well in hand. Shall I call for the King's guard?"
I sat up then, wrapping a sheet about me. "Who is he?"
"I don't know," he swallowed hard. "He says he bears a message, which you must deliver to Lord Anarfiel de Launay. My lady, shall I call for the guard?"
"No." I was too long de Launay's pupil to turn away information. I scrambled for my gown, pulling it over my head in haste. "Sent him in, and Jocelyn with him. Master Thielard?" The old marquis held my gaze a moment, then gestured with his head toward the rear of his shop, where he and his apprentice ground their pigments.
"See him then, Anguissette, and give me no cause to regret it," he growled.
I had barely laced my stays when Jocelyn came through the curtain, driving before him at knife point a youngish man with a sailor's queue and a discomfited look on his face.
"Call off your Castellan hound," he said to me,
grimacing as Jocelyn shoved him into the Marquis's studio.
"I've word that needs be delivered to Lord de Launay."
For what it was worth, I put on my sternest expression as I followed him through the far curtain. Jocelyn gave the sailor one last shove, then sheathed his daggers efficiently, standing between me and the messenger. "Who are you?" I asked the man. He rubbed at his midsection and made a face.
"Elric Lether, of the Mahariel. I'm oath sworn to the Admiral Quintilius Rouse, and here under the standard of the Comte de Brijou of Cushet. I'm supposed to be meeting with your Lord de Launay."
I paused. "How do I know this?"
"Ella was bowls," he rolled his eyes. "There's a password, isn't there? What is it? I swear it on the prince's signet, his only born."
The prince's signet. I thought of the ring that Isandra de la Courcelle had showed de Launay, and schooled my features to expressionlessness. "Very well, then. Why are you here?"
"There are men watching the Comte's manor."
He bent over, still trying to catch his breath.
"Damn you, Castellan, for a hasty fool. I saw him and scried out the situation at Lord de Launay's. He is being watched, too. They're waiting for me. Someone slipped up and gave them word. I saw you leave and followed you here."
It chilled me to realize that de Launay's fears had merit. Motioning Jocelyn to bide, I pressed the sailor. "What word, then, from Quintilius Rouse?" Elric Lether drew in his breath and loosed his message with it.
"When the Black Boar rules in Alba, elder brother will accede. That's my message. That's the whole of it."
I fumbled at my purse, trying to cover my consternation, and found a coin at hand.
It was a gold ducat, but I'd no doubt Delaunay would reimburse me for it. "My thanks, Lord Sailor," I murmured. "I will relay your admiral's message to my Lord Delaunay, and of a surety he will send word." Aelric Leitha was no coward, I am sure of that. No man who sailed with Quintilius Rous could be. But he was out of his element here, and fair frightened. He took the coin, bobbed a bow, with fist to brow, and fled. Through the curtain I saw Master Tielar and his apprentice staring after his disappearing figure. Then I looked at Jocelyn Verai, and the terrible expression on his face. "The house," he said, and headed for the door. I had seen Jocelyn move quickly, and I have seen it since. But that day he rode as if seven devils were after him, and I have never seen him move faster. How I kept a pace of him I don't know, save that terror gave my heels wings, and Alcuin's horse, whom I rode, seemed to sense it when I mounted and laid into his sides. We laid a trail of sparks from the Marquis's shop to Delaunay's door, skittering amid a shower of them into the courtyard. It didn't matter. It wouldn't have mattered how fast we'd ridden. We had dallied too long at Master Robert Tielar's, the sailor, the Castellan, and I. It was too quiet in the courtyard, and no stable-boy came to take our mounts.
"No!"
Jocelyn shouted, dismounting in a flash and charging the door, both daggers drawn.
"Ah, Castiel, no!"
I followed him into the silent house. Whoever had been watching it, they had been there before us. Delaunay's men lay where they had fallen, weltering in their own gore. They'd killed the housekeeper, too, and thrown her apron over her face. I couldn't look. So many servants, and I'd never bothered to know them all, why they'd chosen to share their lives with Anarthiel Delaunay. We found him in the library. There must have been a dozen wounds or more on him. Which had killed him, I do not know. His sword was still in his hand, blood-crusted the length of it. Delaunay's face, unmarked, was strangely peaceful, at odds with the awkward sprawl of limbs. I stood in the doorway while Jocelyn knelt and felt for a pulse. His expression when he looked up said all that was needed. I stared, uncomprehending, my world crumbling. In the dimness of the unlit library, something moved, making a scraping sound. Jocelyn moved quicker than thought, shoving a path through the disarray, volumes and tomes strewn hither and thither. When he saw what it was, he cast his daggers aside, frantically clearing debris away from the source of the sound. I had seen a swatch of hair, like moonlight, glimmer amid the strewn books. I followed slowly. I saw Alcuin's eyes, dark and flooded with pain. Jocelyn cleared away the books that had been tossed heedlessly across him, and I heard his breath hiss between his teeth to see the damage. He pressed both hands to Alcuin's stomach, to the fine cambric shirt drenched with red blood, and shot me an agonized glance. "Water." Alcuin's voice was no more than a thread. I knelt beside him and fumbled for his hand. "Please." "Get it," I murmured to Jocelyn. He opened his mouth, then nodded and disappeared. I held tight to Alcuin's hand. "Delaunay," his dark gaze searched my face. I shook my head, unable to say it. Alcuin's gaze wandered away from mine. "Too many," he whispered. 20 at least."
"Be quiet!"
My voice came out fierce with tears. Jocelyn returned with a ewer and a sponge. Dipping the sponge, he squeezed a trickle of clear water into Alcuin's mouth. Alcuin's lips moved. He swallowed feebly, grimacing.
"Too many."
"Who?" Jocelyn's voice was low and calm.
"D'Angeline."
Alcuin's wandering gaze sharpened, focusing on him.
"Soldiers. No crest. I killed two."
"You?"
I stroked his hair, heedless of the tears spilling down my face.
"Oh, Alcuin."
"Rous," he whispered and grimaced. "Get him word."
"Quintilius Rous?"
I exchanged a glance with Jocelyn.
His messenger found us. Me. He said the house was being watched.
Alcuin whispered something. I strained to hear, leaning close, and he repeated it.
Password.
No. My wits were utterly scrambled. Yes, yes, he gave one. The prince's ring. The prince's signet. His only born.
Alcuin twitched and gasped for air. Jocelyn gave him more water, sponging his face. I saw then, incredibly, that he was trying to laugh.
Not a ring. Signet. Swan. Courcelle. Delaunay. Oath sworn to guard her. Cassio's oath. Roland's daughter.
On our field Delaunay stood as oath-sworn protector of Isandra de la Courcelle, Jocelyn asked quietly.
Alcuin's head moved in a faint nod.
Swore it for Roland's sake, he murmured, licking his lips.
Jocelyn squeezed another trickle of water over them.
What of Rouse?
When the Black Boar rules in Alba, elder brother will accede.
I held Alcuin's fading gaze, pleading.
Alcuin, don't go. I need you. What do we do?
The thread of his voice was fraying, the dark eyes dim and apologetic.
Tell Isandre. Trust Rouse. Trevelyan. The Tavassis knows about Alba.
He stirred again, a slight cough, and blood frothed on his lip.
Such beauty ruined.
I was clutching his hand too hard.
Not Ganelon. Slipping. It's the Dauphine.
His head moved, and I knew he was looking for Delaunay.
He kept his promise.
Alcuin's voice for a moment rang clear. He gasped. His eyes rolled upward and his hand clenched on mine.
Phaedra!
How much time passed, I do not know. I held his hand for a long time, long after it lay limp in my own, and the final spasm of pain had smoothed itself from his features. It was Jocelyn who pulled me away, raising me stumbling to my feet and shaking me. I let him do it, boneless in his grasp, feeling the broken pieces of my heart rattle as he shook me. Beyond the still figure of Alcuin lay Delaunay. I could not bear to look. Gone, all gone, his noble features deceptively calm in the gentle repose of death. The auburn coils of his braid, streaked with silver, lying so seemly over his shoulder, as if no pool of blood clotted beneath him.
Eloa, curse you! Phaedra, listen to me!
The sharp retort of a slap echoed in my hearing. I raised my head, dimly aware of the blow, and met Jocelyn's eyes, stretched wide with terrified urgency.
We have to leave, he said, his voice high and tight. Do you understand? These are professionals. They took their dead with them. They'll trace their steps. They'll come back. We have to deliver Rouse's message to the Dauphine before they do.
He shook me again, and my head lulled.
Do you understand?
Yes. I pressed the heels of my hands into my eyes. Yes, 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 I understand. Let me go.
He did, and I moved without thinking, clutching my cloak about me, the wheels of my mind turning remorselessly. Kushiel's chosen, but Delaunay's pupil.
We'll go directly to the palace. If we can't gain access to the Dauphine, we'll seek Telesis de Mornay.
I dropped my hands, looking at Jocelyn.
She knows me. She will see me.
Good.
His face settled into hard lines, and he caught my wrist, dragging me out of the abattoir that had once been a library. Come on.
Chapter 38.
Of the ride to the palace, I remember next to nothing. That we arrived, I am sure, but I could not say how long it took, nor what the weather, nor who we passed in the streets. Later I saw men in battle fight on for a time after having received their death wounds. I understood, then. Delaunay had laughed, saying mine was an ill-luck name. It amused him that my mother, Night Court taught, had been ignorant enough to choose it. He should not have laughed. He had given me his name. Would that he'd given me better luck with it. Instead, I had given him the luck of mine, the same luck Baudouin de Trevelyan had had of me. I cannot second-guess my own luck. Even now, I know, had my fate not been in Eloa's hand, matters might have fallen out differently. All I know is that, at that time, I would they had. Isandre de la Courcelle's guard turned us away. In the past I had worried about the spectacle we made, I in my sanguin cloak and Jocelyn in Carceline grey. This time I could not have cared less, until I noted the look in the eyes of Telesis de Mornay's servants, who politely informed me that the king's poet was engaged and liked to remain so for some hours yet. Her verses, it seemed, soothed the king, and such sessions were not to be disturbed. I pressed my hands to my eyes and remembered the mirrored passage to the Dauphine's quarters. There are those who map the influence of the stars and claim that our destinies may be charted within. Doubtless such would claim this meeting was fated. But I, who know better, could have guessed that there was no chance to our encounter. It was not such a difficult thing to set a watch on those who guard. No trouble to have word sent whenever an audience is sought. So I know now. Then I merely started dumbly at the sound of Melisande Chara's voice.
Phaedra?
Jocelyn's hands sought his hilts. I simply looked up, feeling her voice like a tug on a bond I'd forgotten I wore. Her brow was furrowed with concern.
What is it?
Her compassion undid me. I felt the tears rise unbidden.
De Launay,
I said at a gasp. I tried to say the words, but they wouldn't come. It didn't matter. I saw her comprehend it. Alcuin, all of them.
What?
I doubt many things in life, even now still. But I do not doubt that my news took Melisande Chara's eye by surprise. This was one emotion she never rehearsed. She had too little cause for genuine surprise. I heard the instrument of her voice in one word unstrung, untuned. Even Jocelyn heard it, releasing his hilts. The nature of her surprise, however, was another matter. When she spoke again, her voice was under control, though she was pale.
"You're in search of the king's guard?"
"No," Jocelyn said. At the same time I answered,
"Yes."
Nothing, not even this, could render me so far out of my senses as to blindly trust Melisande Chara's eye. I dashed the tears from my eyes, impatient with them.
"Yes,"
I said, repeating it more strongly, ignoring Jocelyn at my side. "Do you know where they're quartered?"
"I can do better than that."
Melisande turned to an attendant in Chara's eye livery, standing some paces behind her.
"Summon the captain of the king's guard to my rooms. The captain and no less, you hear? Tell them it's urgent."
He gave a quick bow and headed off purposefully. Melisande turned her attention back to us.
"Come with me," she said gently. "They should be there in a moment."
I had never seen the Shahrazai appointments in the palace. They were luxurious. I remember that. The rest is lost. We sat at a long marble table in the great room, waiting for the guard.
"Drink this."
Melisande poured two glasses of cordial herself, handing them to us.
"Both of you," she added, seeing Jocelyn hesitate. "It will do you good."
I drank mine at a gulp. It had a clear, fiery taste, with a faint aftertaste of honey and thyme, and a hint of something else. It did seem to settle my nerves a little. Jocelyn coughed at the burn of it, and a little colour rose to his face. He looked better for it. Melisande refilled my glass unasked, but when she reached for his, he shook his head.
"Tea, perhaps?"
he asked faintly.
"Of course."
She went to the door and summoned a servant, speaking in a low tone, then sat down, gaze dwelling on my face.
"Do you want to tell me what happened?"
"No." I started shaking and cupped both hands around my cordial glass. My lady, I don't know. We were at the Marquis shop, making the final arrangements for my mark.
My mind raced desperately as I improvised. Even my vision seemed out of focus.
I had to approve it. Master Tielar had changed the design of the finial. It was, I don't know how long.
3/4 of an hour, Jocelyn said, supporting my story. His voice was a little unsteady, but it sounded like it was due to shock and not the half-truth.
Mayhap a little longer.
The servant came with the tea, and he thanked her, sipping it.
When we arrived back at the house,
his hand trembled, and tea spilled into the saucer. He set it down, then willed both hands to steadiness, and picked it up, taking a long drink.
There were signs of battle all over the house, he said grimly, and no one left living to tell of it.
Oh, Unarfil,
Melisande murmured. She glanced toward the door, looking, I thought, for the king's guard. I looked too, but there was no one. A thud sounded at the table. Jocelyn lay slumped, his cheek pillowed on cold marble. The teacup had overturned, and steaming liquid puddled under one limp mail-clad hand. I felt dizzy staring at him, his oblivious unconscious features swimming in my vision.
No, I said. My grip loosened on the cordial glass, and I pushed it away, looking at Melisande with mounting horror. Oh, no, no!
Fedra, I'm sorry.
Her beautiful face was composed and quiet. I swear to you, I never gave an order to kill Delaunay. That wasn't my decision.
You knew! The horror of it crawled over my skin. You used me! Ah, Eloa, I told you myself, Rouse's messenger.
No, I already knew Delaunay was awaiting word from Quintilius Rouse.
With chilling care, Melisande reached out and righted the overturned teacup, setting it neatly back on the saucer.
Why, then,
I whispered, why did you tell me about Prince Roland, if you already knew? I thought you wanted to find out what it meant.
She smiled, smoothing an errant lock of hair out of my dazed eyes.
That Delaunay was oath-sworn to protect the life and succession of Isandre de la Courcelle? Ah, my dear, I've known that for ages. My second husband was a great friend of the king's, and a terrible gossip. Not clever enough to guess that Delaunay meant to keep his promise, but then of that scant handful who knew it, precious few were.
No, it's what he's up to that I needed to know. Why Quintilius Rouse, and what has it to do with the Master of the Straits?
But why me?
It was hard to keep my head upright. Whatever she had put in Jocelyn's tea, there must have been somewhat in the cordial, too, in a lesser quantity.
Do I need a reason?
Still smiling, Melisande traced the line of my brow over my left eye, the one with the dart-stricken mote.
If I had known horror before, it was nothing to this. The power of her touch remained unaltered. Perhaps I do, for Delaunay's pupil. It's a bit like flushing pheasants, you see, when they send the beaters into the brush. I wanted to see which of de Morban's lordlings startled at the mention of your name. It wasn't hard to guess that the Comte de Brijou harbored a messenger for your lord, Phèdre No Delaunay. The blood ran like fire in my veins, a scalding betrayal. I struggled against it, a cord like a noose around my neck, trying to put the pieces together. Whose men then had killed Delaunay? Melisande's? She didn't command an army. The Shahrazai dealt in money and influence, not men-at-arms, not beyond their personal guard. Alcuin could have done it, I thought. He could have fit the pieces. And my tears were as scalding as the terrible desire. Clinging to the thought of Alcuin, I saw the shape of the pattern. Dedlamour. A spark kindled in Melisande's deep blue eyes. She was proud of me for guessing it.
"Delaunay did teach you well," she said with satisfaction. "I'm sorry Isidore wasn't here himself. He'd have had sense enough not to kill Delaunay without finding out what he was about. I wouldn't have relayed word if I'd known how they would botch it. But it's true, you know. Most Carmelines do think with their swords."
"Not Deglamour?"
"No." Rising, she went to the door and gave an order I couldn't hear. I had already guessed that no captain of the King's Guard would be forthcoming. Melisande returned, standing behind me to rest both hands on my shoulders. "No. Isidore Deglamour thinks with more than his blade. He was fostered for 3 years in Cushith, did you know? In House Sharizai." "No," I whispered. "I didn't know."
"It's true."
Her hands continued to move on me, horrible and compelling. I had never truly understood, until then, that Kushiel's victims dwelt in the flames of perdition. Jocelyn lay slumped before me, dead or unconscious, I could not know, and nothing, not even the thought of Delaunay lying in his own blood, not even the memory of Alcuin's dying breath, gasping my name, could stop the tide of longing that threatened me. "Don't," I said, weeping and shuddering. "Please, don't." For a moment she paused. Then I felt her breath warm at my ear.
"Why did the Carseline brother say no, Fedra?" she murmured. Her voice sent a shiver through the marrow of my bones. "When I asked, you said yes, and he said